The Still Small Voice of Conscience, read by the author Joel Skousen. When you finish reading this, you may not view life in quite the same way again, even if you are indifferent about or passionately dislike what I have to say. I do not claim to or presume that the reader will actually change what they are. That's a more difficult and individualized process. But what I do claim is that once a person understands the workings of conscience in detail, they will never be able to escape its constant commentary on one's thoughts, desires, and actions. That is what will be different. Those that already listen well to conscience, perhaps even without realizing it, will understand better how they get reminders, helps, and warning signals, and will better be able to teach others around them about this great secret to life. If you learn to recognize the inspiration and heed its advice, it will become your constant guide to a better life. In contrast, those that become experts in evading the warnings of conscience will not be able to rationalize, make excuses, and justify their own problems and mistakes with the same ease as before. Promptings to change will never be as easy to disregard. Nervous feelings warning about bad habits will never be as easy to hide from again. Now, this might sound negative, but really it is a very big positive. When we develop the self-control to follow conscience accurately and with consistency, we find ourselves living better, happier lives. Eventually, you'll even long for more of its promptings and warnings, simply because by following that little voice in your mind, everything in life goes better. It warns us not to say things we shouldn't, not to buy things we really can't afford, and not to do things that will get us into trouble. It helps us avoid accidents, illness, investment mistakes, and bad judgment. So with those kinds of benefits, why wouldn't everyone want to listen? Simply because we can't take the beneficial promptings without taking the criticism it offers about our improper thoughts and behavior as well. The criticism or guilt feelings that come via our conscience are sometimes so uncomfortable that people become expert at evading it and shutting it down. In fact, most people learn early in their youth to hide from the voice of conscience. They develop a myriad of ways to cover it up, deny it, rationalize it away, and in other ways deaden its tiny whispering so that they can feel good about what they want to do. But in deadening the voice that criticizes and brings legitimate guilt, they also kill the whole goose that lays the golden egg, that source of divine truth that leads to a better life. Of course, the fruit of conscience is not necessarily wealth, but truth, which is ultimately more valuable than gold. My purpose in writing this is to help resensitize your mind to the voice of conscience, and in the process, encourage you to learn to love its promptings and heed its counsel. Almost everyone needs to be reminded from time to time how to recognize the signals of conscience. It's like getting a reality check that rebalances and corrects our self-image, so that we no longer live under the illusions of false pride. I realize that this can be emotionally painful, but the ultimate spiritual consequences of hiding from reality are not very pretty. In its worst form, it leads to haughtiness, verbal abuse of others, and bad judgment, or in its most chronic forms, mental illness or suicide. But those who take the tough road of listening to conscience and develop the self-control to follow its counsel will come to possess an inner peace that will give constancy to their lives amid a world that is headed for increased turmoil. I can't promise you happiness per se in a world that is capable of tremendous cruelty to others, but I can promise you the internal peace that comes from knowing you have done your best in any given circumstance. Many people have periods of happiness here and there in life, but never really get a solid handle on the workings of conscience, because they only selectively listen to the things they want to hear from conscience, picking and choosing what is comfortable or what leads to success in a job or business. But without listening to the personal signals that criticize our bad habits, we make lots of little errors in daily living that eventually add up to bigger problems, including irritations to a spouse and conflict with others. Probably the most crucial signals from conscience are those little warning feelings that precede every instance of bad judgment that is going to cause you trouble or put your life in danger. Often these warning signals are so subtle that they're all too easy to dismiss, even when the consequences are grave. Let me give you a few real-life examples of people who failed to heed the warning voice of conscience and the sad consequences that followed. You will probably see similar habit patterns and mistakes of disregarding conscience in your own background. Hopefully, by seeing how easily these people could have avoided nearly fatal accidents and serious injury by listening, you will be sufficiently motivated to correct any similar bad thinking patterns in your own lives. The Reader's Digest used to have an interesting section each month called Drama in Real Life, with stories of people caught in life-threatening situations that normally lead to heroic acts of rescue or escape. Most all result in tremendous suffering. I've often wondered how differently these situations would have turned out if people had listened to the warning voice of conscience. Rarely do any of them admit to these warnings, even though some make an urgent appeal to God once in trouble. Only a few recall any premonitions or warnings beforehand, though none related to conscience, just strong nervous feelings. In each sample, you will notice there were a series of little mistakes and missed opportunities to see what was coming that were missed. First, there was the bad habit of taking undue risks, especially unnecessary ones that athletic, youthful individuals do for thrills, pride, bravado, daring, or peer pressure. What they all have in common is that the more they engage in danger, the more they desensitize the warning voices in the mind, especially when they have survived similar dangers before. Putting oneself constantly in danger exposes a person to nervous feelings so often it is possible to become insensitive to crucial warnings when you need them most. In the process, one also loses the ability to distinguish between two different types of nervousness. One form addresses the correctness of what you are about to do, and the other reacts to the danger or unfamiliarity itself. Sometimes the act may be dangerous, but still correct to proceed. Other times the act may be safe, physically, but you are warned not to proceed for other timing or moral reasons. That's why all of us have to learn to distinguish between these two types. People who make it a habit of not heeding nervous feelings always make big mistakes eventually. The first stories about excess bravado under peer pressure, where a fellow allows himself to go beyond a barrage of nervous feelings in his quest to, quote, meet the challenge. He was an experienced free solo rock climber and is invited by his climbing partner, who has superior skills, to compete with him. That was his first mistake, climbing dangerous cliffs. He then discovered, as his friend starts out on the first pitch, that he intends to do it without the aid of safety ropes. Second mistake. The more cocky and talented partner taunted him into more and more difficult reaches. This, quote, friend also shows severe insensitivity to conscience and what he pushes others to do. Our hero fails to decline each increasing challenge despite growing fatigue. The tired climber feels extremely nervous about the last death-defying section, but can't resist the taunting of his friend, the third and near-fatal mistake. He described this last desperate ordeal in gripping detail. He barely survived in the end, and his partner made some light comments, further indicating no remorse on his part for the near disaster. At least at the end of his story, the author admits his mistakes and seems determined to not to repeat it. I wonder, though. People who persist in being friends with those who are chronic violators of conscience are asking for trouble. Next, let's look at the bad habit of letting the fact that everyone else does it cloud obvious dangers and undermine the warnings of conscience. There was a young woman who took a job tending the children of a couple working in the bush in Africa. Everyone regularly swims and bathes in the Upulu River, even though there are crocodiles lurking. Well, this is rationalized because the river is the only source of bathing water, and, quote, everybody does it. One would think that prudence would dictate making a shallow, safe pool next to the river, or at least having an armed person present and watching for danger. They did neither, and she was caught in waist-deep water by a huge crocodile while washing her hair. She doesn't mention any nervous premonitions directly related to the attack, but she does mention having felt it was, quote, time to go. She mentions the lateness of the hour. While I cannot be sure without talking to her, often people get nervous signals about something coming they don't know why or what it is directed to. In mentioning the lateness of the hour, was she simply attaching a reason to her nervousness? I don't know. But in any case, despite whatever warning she may have had, she took the time to wash her hair in deep water. A large crocodile grabbed her arm and wouldn't let go, spinning and thrashing her around under the water. A nearby male friend came to help her, and after a terrible death struggle between her, the friend, and the crocodile finally tore her arm off, but she lived. Great heroism on the part of the friend, but definitely avoidable. In the next example, a couple from Europe goes canoeing and camping in Canada. They saw at least two messages from other campers on the lake warning of the presence of an aggressive black bear. They agreed to be cautious and sought out another campsite further down the lake. They found another site with a cabin on it, but it was already partially occupied by some hunters, strangers but not unfriendly. Because of the known danger, the hunters invited them to share the cabin with them. They declined, rationalizing that they came to be in the outdoors and would rather stay in their small tent. They probably wanted their privacy, too, which their little tent would provide. But that tent didn't even come close to providing any protection from the bear attack that came in the morning. The girl escaped, but her companion took the brunt of the attack, only barely surviving with serious injuries. It's amazing how huge consequences come from disregarding very small promptings and warnings. In hindsight, one may question why they didn't get a stronger warning when it was a matter of life or death. But sometimes it's all we get. The crucial point is that the warning was there, however small. They got it, but disregarded it. That's why it's important to develop a habit of always watching out for nervous feelings and not disregarding them so easily. Here are some examples of failures to heed strong and clear warnings. In the first, a couple picked some mushrooms in the wild without any particular training, informal or otherwise, in mushroom identification. But they did call a Korean friend when they got home who knew about mushrooms, indicating they must have felt some anxiety about the danger involved. The friend could not say for sure over the phone, but cautioned them not to eat them until she could come over and check them out. They declined, rationalizing that it would only make them sick, or that, jokingly, they would die together. And they almost did. Next, a surfer in Oregon, who was a victim of a shark attack, didn't specifically mention his own feelings. But he does mention failing to heed several other open warnings of shark danger. First, he noticed schools of fish leaping out of the water, which he knew was a sign of escape from a predator. Secondly, he heard fishermen mention having seen a huge shark 30 miles to the south attack and kill a large sea lion. And third, even as he was paddling out, two other surfers who were leaving said they saw something and felt nervous. Well, somebody listens. He failed to heed all of these warnings and got struck by the shark and barely survived, mostly because of his buoyant surfboard, which kept the shark from dragging him under. Let's suppose he didn't feel any particular nervousness inside, despite the outward warnings. Why do some people get warnings and others not? Well, first, some forms of immoral behavior lead to loss of warnings. If the beneficial warnings or signals from conscience are from a divine source, as I believe, then there may be penalties involved in becoming insensitive, because they get in the way of wrong things a person persists in doing. In another case, a handicapped mother in a wheelchair leaves her young daughter by the swimming pool while she goes to answer the phone. While on the phone, she hears a splash and fails to heed any warning feelings to go back and check, rationalizing instead that it is the dog. By the time she returns, the daughter has drowned and is only barely revived by her heroic efforts. Now, I do not wish to appear harsh about someone else's misfortune, but it often amazes me how tiny the warning signals may be. Most of the time, it is nothing more than a fleeting thought which crosses your mind. It's up to us to grab each interrupting thought and hold on to it until it is analyzed for possible accuracy, and then act upon it, even if there's only a chance it is right. Now, this takes consistent practice until one begins to gain a conviction of its efficacy. So many little thoughts pass through our minds during the day. It becomes easy to treat them all lightly. That's the big danger. In another story, a woman was canoeing in waters known to harbor crocodiles and actually admits to feeling extreme nervousness prior to crossing a stretch of water where the attack occurred. She ignored this clear warning and was severely mauled by the crocodile, barely escaping alive. In another case, a man demonstrated multiple bad judgments in going along with a friend on a Mexican jet ski outing. The friend, an experienced handler of jet skis, talks our future victim into going out into the ocean despite his nervous feelings. He was even more nervous when he sees the patched-up condition of the jet ski he is about to rent. He notes that the operator has to use starting fluid to get it started, a bad omen if you're going far away from land and have to restart it. Sure enough, his machine stops out in the ocean and cannot be restarted. Then there's another error, His buddy offered to take him back in his jet ski, but he was afraid to leave his jet ski behind because of the high deposit required on the rental. So his friend went off to get help, leaving him alone to drift. The jet ski sank, and he was left to drift in the ocean in his life jacket, a mere speck, and is only miraculously found. Finally, there's the sad case of a man with clear, distinct warnings that went unheeded. He was driving on a bumpy orchard road with cans of gasoline or volatile fluid in the back of his vehicle. He disregarded the warning to secure those cans, and shortly after they exploded, engulfing the vehicle in flames. He suffered severe burns and barely survived, attributing much of his recovery to the miraculous hand of God. Sadly, he never mentioned the sad lesson he should have learned, that had he heeded the warning of God through his conscience, he wouldn't have needed the miracle and would not now be permanently disabled. Now let's take some time to discuss in detail the full range of ideas and signs that come from conscience, including warning signals, how they appear, and why they're sometimes difficult to distinguish from our own thoughts. How conscience works. What precisely is conscience and how does it work? Although it is not possible to precisely define conscience in purely scientific terms or determine how it functions physically, I will try to describe the process according to my experience, which is almost identical to hundreds of other people I have talked to. There are several mental experiences that everyone seems to sense regularly in life, some more than others, of course, but these are the universal ones. One, from time to time, thoughts or ideas seem to appear in the mind out of nowhere, which are not linked to what we were thinking about. That feeling that you just got an interrupted or an idea from out of nowhere. Most inventors get key concepts and ideas like this at the moment of a breakthrough, often in the direction different from anything they'd been thinking about previously. Number two, there are little reminders that come to mind seemingly out of nowhere, prompting us to remember something or go back and get something when leaving the house. It could be a reminder to call someone, to think about someone, or do something. I found that when I act upon those reminders, when they come, it often turns out to be very timely. The person is at home when I called, or the person needed help at the time I was reminded to call or visit. There are promptings that push us to do something we know we should do, but don't feel like doing. For kids, it is often a prompting to do homework instead of playing with a friend. For moms, it may be prompted to turn off the television and clean up the house or do the dishes. For dads, it can often be a prompting to fix something the wife has been nagging him about for months, but he feels, quote, too tired or wants to watch television. And for last, but certainly not least, there are those very nervous feelings that warn people from doing something that isn't quite right or a danger to us. It could even be over an offensive word in anger, about eating too much, about buying junk food, splurging on something you can't afford, or making a bad investment. The contrast feeling we're looking for are calm feelings that assurances that you're on the right path. Social scientists have spent considerable time and effort trying to explain these phenomena in terms of environmental preconditioning or subconscious workings of the mind. The mental pressure of conscience is generally referred to as guilt, and many psychologists are quick to ridicule the validity of guilt, especially in matters which do not appear to have an immediate negative consequence. It is true that learned guidelines and environmental experiences can partially precondition the mind, but I do not believe in environmental determinism per se. I believe that environmental influences are compared to our own set of desires and ultimately against our innate personality set points, those innate proclivities to do and believe only that which we're comfortable with. Our own innateness plays a far greater role in explaining why people placed in similar environments aren't affected in the same ways. Some, in fact, are completely immune and unaffected by certain environmental conditions, while others are easily susceptible. Others attribute the foregoing phenomena to some sixth sense, a mystical kind of gut feeling that persons without a religious explanation use to define spiritual experience. Naturally, religious people attribute these things to divine intervention in the lives of mankind. Because the mind interacts with both its own internal preconditioned feelings and external spiritual input, all these explanations can be correct at different times. Let me explain in more detail how I view each of the four listed ways in which we receive influence by our conscience. Number one, ideas that interrupt your train of thought. Everyone experiences occasionally ideas that seem to come out from nowhere, an interruption of our present train of thought. These ideas always form expressions in the mind that sound like our own voice. Same grammar, same syntax, same vocabulary, like talking to yourself. The only thing distinguishable is that the idea itself didn't come from us. It felt like it was external and original. Science alone simply has no credible explanation, in my opinion, for these phenomena, especially when you get a warning about someone else when you had no possibility of knowing that there was a problem other than to attribute it to coincidence. But alas, these kinds of connections between people and unknowable events are simply too powerful to be mere coincidence. You may disagree or have other ideas, but whatever your final conclusion, don't let it stop you from becoming more aware of the phenomenal accuracy of conscience in interacting with and prompting us about our thoughts and actions. I believe that whenever thoughts are processed in the conceptual middle of the brain, there's a receptor that is capable of receiving spiritual input. Now, what is spiritual input? I think it's simply a refined medium of communication different from anything we can measure in the physical spectrum. But there exists an ability of the mind to detect these spiritual signals. And although the mind is an idea processor, it doesn't appear to be able to distinguish easily the original source of any idea unless they come through one of the five senses: to see, to feel, to hear, to touch, to smell. Neither can it tell from whence an idea is received when it comes from outside the mind, except when our own thoughts are interrupted by something that's a clear departure from our present train of thought. In addition, there are two different spiritual sources of ideas that can come into our minds. One is the inspiration and promptings we may receive from divine sources, and the other type are temptations and enticements from opposing satanic forces. Neither divine nor satanic influences in the mind are accepted by the academic world because they cannot be proven or measured scientifically, but they are nevertheless quite real. I believe everyone receives external spiritual influence, whether they consciously acknowledge them or not. In fact, it really isn't necessary to know their nature to make use of them. And that may even be preferable from God's testing purposes, if the man doesn't know the source from where they come. What makes the two forms of spiritual communication difficult to prove or even detect is that they both come into the mind as ideas that sound like our own words and thoughts. It is therefore both easy and natural to confuse them with our own human input and analysis. This adds to the interesting nature of life's test we are going through. Thinking is a fairly conscious process. Sometimes it's not deliberate, as when your thoughts are just drifting from one thing to another, but the better thinkers in life are consciously aware of the thinking process and heading in a distinct mental direction most of the time. In contrast to this conscious thinking process, external spiritual input always comes as a very subtle interrupt in your thought patterns. This happens most often when the mind is not engaged in heavy rational thought or external sensory overload, that is, when it's open to being interrupted. They may or may not have to do with the subject in your mind, but generally one can recognize them as external since they come as a surprise. Try to distinguish these interrupts from random thoughts. Some people's minds are much less ordered than others and have lots of idle random thoughts. These people have the most difficult time perceiving external spiritual impressions, often because they've learned to tune out almost all random thoughts rather than go through the more difficult exercise of controlling and analyzing what they're thinking about. This is an excellent way to learn to discipline the mind. Force yourself to concentrate on every thought that floats into the mind and analyze it for credibility. When you do that, not only do you find that some ideas are valuable, but there are many worthless ramblings as well. And as you start to analyze and classify these random thoughts, you will naturally start to have less of the truly wandering variety, simply because the processing of analyzing and classifying ideas naturally brings order and discipline to the mind. Number two, reminders. These are some of the most pleasant helps that come from an active conscience. The prompting to go back into the house for something you forgot, or the reception of a hint to look in a certain place when searching for something lost. You might be reminded to pay a bill before it's overdue, or to call someone you've had trouble reaching. When you respond right away, things go better. I have found that if I disregard a reminder, I usually don't get reminded again, and only remember on my own when I was reminded once it's too late. In business, you may be reminded to do something now, even though there seems to be no immediate pressing need, and later you learn that something unexpected came up, confirmed why it had to be done then. In finance, you may be prompted to take some financial action before anyone realizes the market is going to change. I've also found it very valuable to assume reminders are from a divine source and to give thanks and credit accordingly. After doing this for many years, I now have the conviction that because of this attitude of gratitude, I get a lot more beneficial reminders than I did as a youth. Perhaps someone out there is pleased when someone recognizes this divine source of reminders, blessings, and warnings. Number 3, promptings. The kind of promptings I will address here have to do with nagging feelings from conscience that you should overcome some bad habit or do something specific we know we should do but don't feel like doing. They can often feel like a reminder, but the difference is the reminders are usually about something you aren't resistant to. Promptings almost always are pushing you to act because the source of the prompting knows you're going to be resistant. Most people get these all the time, and these are the promptings of pushing feelings of conscience that nobody wants to hear. When we tell those to go away, we are unwittingly telling the Lord to get lost, and He does distance Himself, an unintended consequence that will eventually prove costly towards our long-term progress. When one makes a habit of disregarding promptings to change and improve, one no longer merits certain common blessings like protection, good judgment, freedom from illness, at least not in the same degree as before. When we regularly deny inspired suggestions, we are often left to fend for ourselves and sometimes denied help when we want it most. Some talented people do quite well on their own by the world's standard without paying attention to conscience, but they never know what they're missing had they learned to seek both professional competency and divine guidance. How does one calculate the value or merit of information one never receives? We can't, but are simply left on our own. And we wonder why things just don't seem to go as well anymore, or why life doesn't seem to have any spark anymore. Eventually, major errors begin to creep in, some moral, some not. The cutoff of inspiration is gradual, just like the acquisition of a refined conscience. The Lord always, almost always, avoids immediate consequences to enhance this earthly test, so it's not obvious that there are eventual consequences for mistakes of bad judgment. All of us remember the promptings we got as teenagers to do our homework when we least felt like it. Rationalizations would flood in. You could do it later. You can do it after you play for your friends, etc. Both teens and adults deal with the daily promptings to get up on time or to help your mom or wife with household chores when you would rather watch TV. Some of the hardest promptings to handle are the ones that prompt you to do something better with your time than what you're doing, when it's not actually wrong, but not in the best use of your time. In short, promptings almost always come when you are resistant, proving that you really need that nudge. It takes a lot of internal self-control to overcome your natural weaknesses and to get good at always doing what you know you should do, especially when you don't feel like it. Following that little rule, as I will discuss later, is the best defense against depression. Lastly, you need to distinguish between nagging feelings that come from a recurring expectation from job, church, spouse, or family that are not really what you should be doing at the specific time. In other words, sometimes you feel nervous about acceding to a recurring demand when there's something better or more important that you should be doing. That's what conscience is for, to help you order your priorities when there are multiple conflicting demands, none of which might be wrong. Don't let other people or expectations make you feel guilty about things when you know there is something more important that you should be doing at that specific time. It may even be for the sake of your own health or stress level that conscience will tell you to decline an obligation rather than spread yourself too thin. Learning to say no when you feel right about your decisions, without regret. Always let conscience be your guide above rigid or set expectations. Number 4, nervous feelings. Whenever we receive any temptation or create a thought of our own volition that is incorrect or less than correct, we'll always receive a negative feeling either from our own mind when it has been trained to analyze correctly, or lacking that from the divine source through conscience, or both. Most often this signal from conscience appears as an instantaneous nervous feeling, anxiety, or fear as to the correctness of the thought or intention. It is usually very subtle, and less life-threatening when it may be quite strong. When people make a habit of ignoring nervous feelings, they become callous to them, and they run the risk that these critical signals become almost imperceptible to them. There are significant differences in people's ability to sense these little nervous feelings and warning signals, especially in the small things. Some people are simply more sensitive to divine truths than other people, and it isn't necessarily related to the presence of organized religious training. Many people seem to feel divine promptings or warnings even in the absence of religious training. And others who receive a lot of formal religious training don't necessarily feel comfortable with it and do not internalize the still small voice of conscience. There's also the factor that all religious teachings may not be equally correct or divine, which may act as a stumbling block for some very good people who don't feel comfortable in organized religion. You might expect or hope that the warning signals of conscience would be stronger and clearer the greater the danger or the mistake, but that isn't necessarily true. Sometimes we get penalized for years of disregarding conscience, and sometimes for people who are brought up correctly by their parents and who know better, the Lord turns down the volume to a mere whisper sometimes to help us further refine our sensitivity to truth and to test our allegiance to even the smallest hint of error. These nervous feelings could even disappear altogether if people become so hardened in evil desires and thus become insensitive to them that they no longer hear them. God is very reluctant to break the hidden veil around the earth that obscures the spiritual world around us and which keeps his presence hidden. That's part of this earthly test, to see who could sense small spiritual signals rather than wait for some big dramatic intervention from God. It's important to differentiate between the nervous feelings that come from conscience and other normal nervousness that comes as a result of having to do something unfamiliar, new, or outside our comfort zone. For example, a young person might be asked to give a short talk in front of an audience. It may be proper and good, yet he feels very tense about it, as in stage fright. Thus, it's important to realize and to teach your children the difference between nervousness related to the correctness and that which comes from doing something new or unfamiliar. One way to resolve the question is to ask yourself a question that addresses the rightness of the action. Should I be doing this? Is it the right thing to do? Assuming it is right, one will feel calm about answering yes to the question. Even if you're still nervous about the performance, sometimes, if still in doubt, it helps to reverse the question and ask if it's wrong to do this. By now, the correct answer should be more clear. Sometimes there are legitimate gray areas of doubt, especially when dealing with situations where there's nothing wrong with the action. It's wholly legal and good by everyone else's standards. But there still exists some doubt. Worse yet, one might feel good about it, but a parent or spouse may not. What do you do then? In these cases, we have a conflict between someone's mind and another's conscience. Which one is getting the proper signal? I recommend one or two approaches. Sometimes it's helpful to seek out the advice of another person whose judgments you know to be wise and trustworthy, and who is good at listening to conscience. Ask for their opinion before you give them any rationalizations or justifications about the issue. Trustworthy, wise people may not always be those we consider our closest friends. Learn to distinguish between people you like and people in whom you have higher trust in their wisdom or good judgment. Hopefully, every parent should strive to be such a person of trust for their own children. In like manner, every person should make it his highest priority to find a mate with a solid feeling for conscience. One of the most interesting things I learned from my mother's refined intuition is that wives can often spot or sense a bad business deal, even when they know nothing about the technical matters involved. Sometimes it's easier for them to feel the nervous feelings of conscience since they are not wrapped up in the business process or in the desire to make it go through. Every one of the bad business deals made by my late father was presaged by my mother, who could always sense when my father was going to have problems with an unreliable business partner. My mother's judgment never failed, and my father didn't always learn from his business mistakes. Other than this flaw in his investment decision-making, he was otherwise a a wise and loving father with deep spiritual insights into life. If you have no source of trust to check your doubts with, start mentally going forward with a plan in your mind. If it's in the wrong choice, the nervous feeling should increase the closer you get to action. That's a definite warning sign you don't want to miss. In fact, the presence of rationalizations is always an indication that you don't feel calm about it. With high-risk financial decisions, there can also be the additional risk of digging yourself into a hole, where one bad investment leads to more pressure to salvage it with yet another risky deal. It takes courage sometimes to walk away with a modest loss rather than get deeper into a bad situation. Unfortunately, like in a commitment to marry the wrong person, too many people get so far down the road that pulling out can be very embarrassing and expensive. Nevertheless, I've found that it's always better to listen to the warnings of conscience, no matter what the consequences, even if one has to notify all the guests that the wedding is called off. I've stopped counting the number of divorced people I've known who had such warnings in their mind after they committed to marriage, but were too embarrassed to back out. Calm feelings. This is a contrast to the nervous feelings. The positive side of conscience works like this. When we think of appropriate thoughts and actions, we will feel calm about them, as do the correctness. It is still natural to be anxious about new or difficult things ahead, even when correct. In reality, these calm assurances are what produce the internal peace that comes from doing what is right. Most of the time, calm feelings are simply the complete absence of doubt and nervous feelings about the correctness. One of the most important things naturally fearful people can learn when confronted with constant worry about a child or spouse who's away is simply to ask, "Is he okay? Will he be all right?" If true, you'll feel a calm confirmation, and then you can stop worrying about it and trust your feelings. Sometimes that takes some self-control to force yourself to stop worrying and trust your feelings and conscience. Watch out for rationalizations. In contrast with the above, evil spiritual forces attempt to imitate calm feelings whenever possible. This is most often done by getting people to rationalize away nervous feelings, or in other ways, talk themselves into something that isn't right. Everyone knows what that process feels like. Rationalizations are especially powerful when they match your own desires to do something. When you want something badly enough, watch out for powerful rationalizations which may drown out nervous feelings. It's important to establish a habit pattern of learning to recognize rationalizations just as they begin and to cut them off. The deeper one gets into these excuses, the more the false hope increases that it will turn out well when it won't. Rationalizations are a trap. Be careful also not to be guilty of trying to feed rationalization to someone else you may want to have join you in an activity. His or her nervousness may be your last chance to escape future consequences, since you may already be past feeling the proper nervous feelings. So why do so many people persist in pushing past those warnings, even when they know better? As mentioned above, it is often because they established a habit pattern of disregarding conscience very early in life, or heeding peer pressure too often. Sometimes it's also the failure of parents to reinforce and correct conscience when their children are young. All too often, one parent will intervene with the one who is upset and offer permissive counsel like, "Let them go, dear, they're just having fun." Bad judgment like this isn't easily corrected, even in the face of continual problems with your kids. Permissive parents tend to excuse continued problems as if they aren't permissive or loving enough. That's where innate resistance to tough discipline in a parent causes a real blind spot, where they only feel nervousness about being too strict and not about being too permissive. All too often, the parent's own conscience has become so clouded that they don't even feel intolerance for bad behavior in children. It has long been a source of consternation to me when observing families with out-of-control children, where the children's behavior doesn't seem to bother the parents at all, or at least not enough to stop it. Differentiating good and evil signals in conscience. Promptings of the Lord always point you in the directions that will ultimately feel right about doing. Satanic temptations and enticements, on the other hand, are not so predictable. While they more often than not appeal to the carnal or egotistical side of your desires, they may involve complete falsehoods or even partial truths, depending on how the dark side thinks they can best get you to make an error. Thus, you cannot judge the source of external spiritual input by the substance of the thought alone. Satan will often use full truth, partial truth, or even excess truth, meaning more than that which is appropriate for the circumstances, to get you to make a mistake. Ultimately, the loss of internal peace and confidence will, if humbly recognized, indicate the nature of this source of the ideas. Once given some training and expectations, conscience can now begin to prompt them in little ways. Once you develop a good routine at home with chores and with the kids, and lists of things that they can do or learn in their spare time, you'll start to see they still come up with "I'm bored" routine. That's a good time to suggest they check their mind for what they should be doing. If they immediately come up with a string of rationalizations and excuses of why they don't want to do those things, then you know they are starting to be fed excuses from the dark side of conscience. It's natural. It happens to all of us. But it's a good opportunity to sit down with them and explain how to tell the difference between the good promptings we get and the negative excuses that come into the mind to stop us from doing what's right. It takes a few years of interacting with your children about what they are feeling and what you are feeling and what they are feeling for these concepts to sink in and become natural for them. Don't think that you can sit them down and explain conscience from A to Z and be done with it. It is in the little reminders and corrections you give a child about his or her conscience that is most effective. But hardly anyone even thinks consciously about conscience anymore, let alone how to correct it in others. That's why we've become a rule-making people and a legalistic society. It's a poor system except in helping citizens avoid major crimes. At the micro level of life, rules are never specific enough to cover every situation and every contingency, so it's natural for people to think they have a lot of leeway in their behavior between the rules. But they don't, really. Conscience has an opinion about almost everything, though it won't allow you to use it as a Ouija board, asking yes or no questions on who to marry or what stocks to put your money into. Mental habits that deter the operations of conscience. There are two tendencies in behavior that lend themselves to problems with conscience. The first are people that don't control their thoughts or expressions well. Those types of people tend to get the most false signals and often develop chronic bad judgment. The second are people who think too fast or flip from one thing to another without thinking. They need to consciously slow down in order to hear the small voice of conscience, as I suggested with training children. A third group are intellectual and scientific-oriented people who lack any feelings for seeking out or dealing with spiritual promptings. Intellectual and scientific pursuits require very heavy emphasis on the deductive and inductive thought processes from sensory inputs alone. They also take great care to exclude random and non-traceable inputs. This can easily lead to biases against feelings or the acceptance of spiritual input that can't be proven. Not all intellectuals have this problem. Increasing your self-control. It does little good to hear the promptings of conscience unless someone develops sufficient self-control to force yourself to follow those promptings. Conscience is an internal process. Once you've left home, there's no one to prod you to do what you know you should be doing by your conscience. So if you haven't developed ample self-control skills, you will fail at what I'm trying to teach here. Perhaps not in the listening part, but certainly in the follow-through part. For example, people who often get reminders from conscience to do something and put it off until it is convenient. That may involve listening to a rationalization or it may be a lack of self-control. It takes a lot more self-control to abide by a prompting in conscience because the voice or idea is so tiny and because there's no one hovering over you to enforce it. And though there usually are consequences for evasion and procrastination eventually, they may not show up for years. And by that time, you probably won't even relate the failure to your chronic failure to listen and act. So how do we improve self-control? The answer lies in the interesting link between the physical and the mind. When the mind is required to put pressure on the physical side of self, either to suppress improper or untimely urges or make it perform something difficult, the mind gains strength and gets better at controlling urges that come from a complaining body. The mind does not develop the same degree of self-control when it is only required to operate on mental aspects alone. The mental effort required to suppress an idea is often easier than suppressing strong physical drives. Thus, it is no surprise that forcing yourself to do strenuous and invigorating physical exercise is one of the best ways to develop mental self-control. Hard breathing, calorie-burning exercises are perfect for improving both mental and physical strength. There is also something about the slow fatigue that builds up over long distances and time with aerobic exercise that builds endurance and mental toughness. If you are not used to heavy exercise, get a good checkup and work up gradually in your toughening process. Once a person has developed good mental powers over physical control, they need to start applying this control to other weaknesses. Being overweight is a common but tough one. Bad speech or conversation habits are another, and these are especially difficult to break. Ultimately, one needs to apply themselves to eliminate bad mental habits of daydreaming, drifting, or erratic thinking. Correcting conscience. The most common problem with conscience is people's tendency to make permanent rationalizations and seal off reception of certain signals. They no longer want to hear the warnings. In other words, people talk themselves into accepting that a problem is no longer a problem or that it is beyond their capacity to change. They become immune to any future nervous feelings on that subject, and their judgment begins to deteriorate in other areas. Here's a list of some of the most common areas where people cut off the signals of conscience and no longer hear them. Eating junk food, overeating in general and accepting their weight problem. Ignoring bad behavior in their children. Watching too much TV and unhealthy movies, music, books, or other entertainment. Indulging in addictions, alcohol, pornography, smoking, etc. There are many more, but those are some of the most common in our society. It's hard for any person to see what they are missing in conscience, but others close to them can see faults more easily. Your parents, spouse, or close friends can sometimes be your biggest help in correcting conscience. They will often be reluctant to intervene and help unless you invite them in to give you helpful observations. There are risks in that of potential offenses, but not so much if you are dealing with someone who is also good at listening to conscience. They'll hear the signal and know how to tread properly on your feelings. There are many professional people who are often encouraged by people to help, but most of these don't understand any of the principles that I've espoused here. Most of the rehab or self-help professionals developed for dealing with these problems involve gimmicks to reduce the pain of change. In fact, many will tell you that self-control doesn't work. In reality, self-control always works. It is people that fail to develop enough of it or the mental strength to endure the pain that all change requires. The great thing about getting good about listening to conscience and finding the control to abide by it is that these larger addictions never happen. If they do, applying yourself to the little self-control restrictions of conscience will help build the mental strength to tackle the larger addictions with the help of God, family, and friends. Suicide and conscience. Lastly, I have to mention suicide because it's become epidemic in our society and is a classic case of satanic voices overwhelming the divine voice inside one's mind. The major flaw in professional counseling is that establishment training in psychology denies the most important factor involved in suicidal thoughts, the overwhelming role of satanic depression in a person's spirit. They either don't believe in Satan or have been conditioned by their secular training to never touch religious principles or to excuse all depression as chemical imbalance treatable with mood-altering drugs that I have found actually suppress the workings of conscience. When SSRI drugs are used to treat depression, I believe that they end up suppressing the mind's reception of the signals of conscience, including the bad signals from satanic influences that often cause mental problems and erratic behavior. That's why they appear to work while the patient is on these drugs. These drugs are used a lot to help children overcome or suppress chronic ADD and other mental control problems that have some pretty bad side effects. During withdrawal from these drugs, there appear to be a high correlation between withdrawal and suicidal thoughts, which many have complained about. My personal opinion is that this is caused by the sudden reintroduction of satanic influence on the mind that was suppressed before. I found out about this suppression of conscience while trying to help a good friend's teenage daughter who was abusing drugs and having moral problems. I taught her about the workings of conscience in order to resensitize her mind to those divine corrective signals. But she clearly didn't like hearing them, not wanting to change her behavior. Her parents finally took her to a psychiatrist who put her on mood-altering drugs, and she seemed to improve for a while, at least in attitude. I saw her about a month later with her new carefree mental attitude and asked her what made the difference. She said, "Once on this drug, I couldn't hear that nagging voice of conscience anymore." That was a wake-up call for me. Yes, the high level of satanic influence might be suppressed while on a drug, yielding temporary stability, but she was no longer getting the corrective voice of conscience either. And with the crutch of mood-altering drugs, people rarely learn to overcome their own problems until they get off of them and tie into the beneficial signals of conscience. So parents, beware of the lure of psychotropic drugs, the dumbing down of conscience, and their potential link to suicide. I've had a younger brother commit suicide, and I've known several others who have succumbed to it. I've never met anyone with suicidal thoughts that wasn't under the constant barrage of satanic depression, feeding them thoughts about how there's no way out except by killing themselves. More than just trying to talk someone out of their negative thoughts, it's important to teach them how Satan can also speak to their mind without them recognizing it, because everything coming through conscience comes in their own voice and grammar. People with suicidal thoughts always think they're talking to themselves, but it isn't necessarily true. Teach them that any idea about killing themselves is coming from Satan. It's not really them, and how to resist it. The two rules of conscience really help here. When anyone is depressed, remind them of rule number two, to stop sulking and get up and do something that they know they should be doing, especially now that they don't feel like it. If you've raised your children with this habit since they were young, they should already have developed the self-control to know how to force themselves to do something productive when depressed. It's the most important training you can give them so that they develop a natural resistance to suicidal thoughts. Sadly, few parents watch out for the early signs of depressive inaction, always preceded by bad attitudes. Many have not learned how to discipline bad attitudes and get their children into productive action when depressed. If you don't teach this early on and expect them to do it, it will be much, much harder to do when under the influence of severe satanic depression, which often comes in their teens or young adulthood. Don't forget to pray your heart out as well for satanic spiritual influences to be lifted from your home, and teach your kids to pray deeply as well when they recognize Satan's influence on them. That said, remember that you can't pray away satanic influence if you are permissive and allow bad influences to enter your home constantly through television, cell phones, books, or the influence of problem friends in public schools. Parents have to do their part to merit divine help. Remember that a lot of societal shielding is necessary in today's world until children get old enough and strong enough spiritually to see and resist. That's why homeschooling has now become so popular to discerning parents. Conclusion. Within the workings of conscience are found the essence of our final examination on earth. No matter what you do publicly on earth, no matter how much fame, fortune, or power you accumulate, the core judgment concerning your conduct on earth will center around how you have reacted to the thousands of promptings you received in conscience over a lifetime. We've all made mistakes, but no matter what has gone on before, we can always repent, change, and begin the healing process by linking yourself to the still small voice of conscience, which will lead us back to that God who sent us here. It takes many years to become accurate and sensitive to the whisperings of conscience, even when we try our very best to listen and obey, so be patient. Learn to love the still small voice of conscience and always be on guard for correction. Commit yourself to act when you know what is right, especially when you don't feel like it. That is the key to a better life. Thanks for listening.